Okay, so today we continue our study of the Satipatthana Sutta. Scroll way down to the modes of materiality, which should really be contemplation of elements. And the translator has used this word or phrase, modes of materiality, which is quite bizarre, really. I was trying to look up the word dhatu to try to figure out where he's getting this translation from, and I still don't quite get it. The word dhatu is much related to the word dhamma or dharma, which comes from the root to carry or to hold. In Sanskrit, the root is dhar, which means to hold. So the connotation is, as with the connotations of the word dharma or dhamma, are that it has essential nature of its own, essential qualities. So the connotation is that these are the atomic particles or the indivisible aspects of nature, the ultimate reality of the physical is the dhatu, the four elements. So the word elements, I think, is quite a proper translation. Not sure why he didn't go with that. So this this particular type of meditation, meditating on the dhatus, because these are the basic elements of physical reality, they also serve as a basis of the practice of insight meditation. And this is pointed out by the path of purification, the Visuddhimagga. When you first get into the first paragraph that talks about the development of wisdom, the section on wisdom has a lot of theory in the beginning about what is wisdom and what are the things that one has to come to understand. And then it asks, well, how do you do this? How do you come to see these things? And the answer it gives is the practice of the elements. It says, refer back to the practice of the elements, which was described in the section on concentration. So it's out of the 40 meditation topics discussed in the Visuddhimagga, it's the one meditation technique that is explained as the method of practice in both sections, in both the section on concentration and the section on wisdom. So it's special in that regard. And the reason for this is because this is the essential, as I said, the essential building blocks of nature. When you talk about walking, you're talking actually about the essence of walking is the four elements, the essence of sitting, the essence of standing, the essence of eating and drinking and so on. Talking, the physical manifestation of talking, is the four elements. All of the things that we do during the day, it's made up of the four elements. Our experience of the physical is the experience of the four elements. This is, I think, important to understand in terms of helping us to get a overall summarial picture of what it means to be mindful of the body. Being mindful of the body, in essence, means being mindful of these four elements. And so it can be performed differently if you're trying to develop tranquility or if you're trying to develop insight. If your intention is to develop tranquility, then you would use the 32 parts of the body talked about in the last section. And you would examine them as being the earth element. And you would try to get this... You would use some kind of mantra, I suppose. I'm not sure, actually, if you could develop concentration. I can't remember. It probably doesn't lead to the jhanas, to the summit of jhanas. But one, you know, for the practice of samatha or tranquility meditation, one can just understand and look and see and say, this is the earth element or so on. But in the practice of vipassana, it doesn't exactly work that way. One has to experience the elements as they arise. One can't think of one's hair and focus on the idea of hair or the concept of hair as being physical. No, one has to actually feel the hair, for example. So when you're washing your hair or so on, and you feel the hardness of the hair as you rub it, when you say to yourself feeling, you're being mindful of the earth element, the hardness of the hair or softness or so on. Or if you'd simply say to yourself, rubbing, rubbing, or washing, washing, scrubbing, scrubbing, you're also being aware of the earth element and being aware of the movements in the hand, in the arm, which are the air element, and the heat or the cold of the water or so on is the fire element. When you chew your food, you have the crunchiness, this is the earth element, and you have the squishiness, that's also the earth element. You have the pressure of the food as the air element. So thinking about this is a means of developing tranquility. If you focus on it and have a mantra out of it and just repeat it to yourself, going through the parts of the body, then your mind will become tranquilized. Whether you'll actually get the jhana or not, I can't remember. I don't think so, according to the texts. But when you practice vipassana, you're actually taking up the practice of the postures and so on, the minor postures. And if you look, that's really what's being said in this in the first paragraph. Yatha titang yatha panihitang. This is however the body is disposed or placed, is really talking about the four postures, etc. You know, the four major postures, and the commentary explains this, that what this means is that in regards to the postures of walking, standing, sitting, and lying down, one is aware of the elements that compose the movements, that make up the movements of the body. If we go back to anapanasati, it also can be mindful of the elements when you're focusing on the stomach rising and falling, or when you're focusing on the nose or the lip, feeling the heatness or the heat or the cold or the pressure in the body. It all boils down to mindfulness of the elements. So if you're taking this as a direct meditation practice, then you would break up the body into the 32 parts, just as the skilled or the clever cow butcher, having slaughtered the cow and divided it, sees the parts of the cow, like this is a leg joint, this is a rib, and this is and so on. These are the parts of the cow. One can take the parts of the body, the hair, head hair, the body hair, and the nails, teeth, skin, and so on, and see it as being which of the elements it is. And the commentary goes into quite some detail. But you can see that the Buddha isn't really going into detail. One thing that the Buddha does say is the junction of the four crossroads where one sits. Chattu maha pathe bilaso vibhajitva. No, just chattu maha pathe, sitting at the junction of a four crossroad. Nisi no asa should be sitting, having separated out the cow at the great, at the four-way intersection of a great highway or so on. And the commentary picks up on this, that actually it's not just a simple word that the Buddha is using. The four do refer to the four postures. That in the Buddha's exposition of this, he's really just talking about the four postures and the movement of the four postures and how it relates to the elements. So it's an inclusion, or it's a different way of explaining what has already been explained. That when in whatever of the four postures, which is what is meant by according as the body is placed or disposed, just as the butcher sits at the four-way intersection, so the monk looks at the four postures of the body, or etc., however the body is disposed, crouching or reclining, or all of the minor postures of eating and drinking and talking and showering and urinating and defecating and so on. One understands them to be the elements. And this is accomplished through a basic practice of Satipatthana. One way we can understand the repetition and the fairly deep division of the Satipatthana, or the Kaya Nupassana anyway, in terms of breaking it up into different parts into quite some detail, is because this would be a meditation teaching. It would be something that he would be explaining as people were sitting there meditating. So we don't have to think of this as theory and say, wow, which one of these will we be mindful of? This would be something that the Buddha would be explaining to people for the purpose of, as he's explaining it to them, they can come to practice it and they can reflect upon all of these. So you start by introducing the easy to understand, which is, for example, the breath is some easy way to calm the mind down. Then you have them be aware of the postures of the body, getting closer to what is ultimately real. And then from the postures you go on and come finally to the elements. And in regards to the elements, or in regards to the postures, you have people understand what's really involved with the postures. Because as you progress in the meditation, instead of seeing the postures, when you say to yourself sitting, instead of really seeing that you're sitting, you become aware of the pressure in the back and the pressure in the bottom and the pressure in the legs of how you're sitting. Or when standing, you have the pressure in the legs and the pressure in the back and so on. When walking, the same, the pressure in the legs, the pressure in the hips, the pressure in the back. This is what you understand in regards to the postures. So it's a natural progression in terms of the explanation. And I've given this talk several times, not in nearly the detail that the Buddha gives it, but this is how I would teach guided meditation, going through the four Satipatthana. And as the people are meditating, have them explain to them one Satipatthana after another. And it works quite well, I think, as a introductory meditation exercise or an introduction to the meditation practice. And so we don't have to think of this or any of these as really alternative meditation practices. We should think of them as a progression. So if you want to do a self-progression, then you can go through these on your own, thinking about one section after another in your practice. But you can also think of it as a way of understanding what is meant by satipatthana for people who have never practiced. Once you're practicing, then it's really enough to just focus on the four postures and the minor postures. When you're bending, know that you're bending. When you're stretching, know that you're stretching. And you might come back and read the various sections to help clear up, and you say, oh yeah, that was the air element, or that's the earth element. So when you wonder, what is this, what is that, you say, it all boils down to the four elements. So not too much to say here. I don't want to spend lots and lots of time on each section. If anyone has questions, you're welcome to ask. Or if you have something you'd like to point out, please by all means. But otherwise, let's try and go a little bit quicker through this. Maybe that's why people have dropped off. It's going too slowly. But anyway, we go at our own pace. Next section, the final section of the body, Kaya Nupasana, or Kaya, the Satipatthana of the Kaya Satipatthana, Kaya Nupasana Satipatthana, is the cemetery contemplations. And I don't know that there's that much to say about this. I don't want to go into detail, but what does it mean to talk, what is a swollen corpse, and what is a blue and festering corpse, and so on. Commentary does a good job of this. The Visuddhimagga does a good job of this. It's quite a long section, but the best way to go through the cemetery contemplations is just to read them for yourself. How this fits into Kaya Nupasana, it's kind of interesting because you're no longer paying attention to your own body. And this is what I said earlier on about how when the Buddha talks about being internally reflecting on the body, or reflecting on the body internally, externally, both internally and externally. I think this is somehow what he means, that in one way of understanding what he means by this, that I think the commentary agrees as well, that in some cases one will be reflecting on using another person's body. When one sees a dead person, one then goes back and thinks of one's own body as being also subject to that, which is a very powerful meditation tool. When you look at this body, and ordinarily you think of it as me, as mine, and under my control. When you see a dead body, it can be quite powerful. There are people who actually go into morgues and stare at these dead bodies, chopped up bodies. And it can be quite profound, and it can have an effect on one's bodily attachment, the smells and so on. You see handsome or beautiful human body with its head chopped open, or its entrails sticking out. And we have pictures of these. People who don't go to the morgue, they study pictures of them. So pictures of beautiful or handsome bodies that have been mutilated or cut apart, dissected by doctors. And it has a profound effect on how one approaches or regards one's own body. So it can be a cause of giving up lust, for example. It can also be a cause for giving up negligence, thinking that this body is permanent, realization that it is not permanent, that this life could end at any time, and eventually it will end. As the Buddha said, Acirang vatayang kayo patuvingati seesati. After no long time, this body will lie on the ground. Atisesati jutto apeta vinyano, with the consciousness having left it, having departed it. Jutto apeta vinyano. Nirathang vakalingkarang. Nirathang, with no, useless as a charred log. Nirathang vakalingkaro, having become useless as a charred log, as a piece of wood. the realization that this body also, this is often the reflection that people will have at funerals. When they go to see a dead corpse, monks will go and look at the corpse and recite this. Anicca vata sankhara, they'll say that first, and then Achirang vata yankayo patuvingati sesati. Chuto apeta vinyano niratang vakalingkarang. So that's, I think, enough to say about that. But worth reading. I'm not trying to dismiss this section. Worth reading and thinking about. And actually much more worth going to a charnel ground and actually looking, or going to a morgue and actually looking at the dead body, or when you go to a funeral, spending some time looking at the corpse and reflecting. So, scroll way down after this, the end of the ninefold section on the cemetery, the end of the 14-fold insight into the body. And now we come to Vedananupassana. The Vedananupassana and Jittanupassana are actually quite short. There's not much to say because they're very simple. And I think in this sense we can understand body as being quite simple as well. We don't have to spend a lot of time on all the sections. It just gives us some basic or some background knowledge on how to practice the body. Another reason why the body is so much time is spent on the body is because it's the most coarse. It's the one that we're going to spend the most time being mindful of. It's the one that's more or less always there. Almost always there. Almost always clearly discernible. And so it's going to be our prime meditation object no matter what. When we undertake mindfulness of the Satipatthanas, mindfulness of the body will be the most most often contemplated. Because the others will only come from time to time. For instance, Vedananupassana, in fact, it is always there, but in most cases, it's a neutral feeling, and there's not much to be mindful of. There's not much to be aware of. It's not of great prominence. So unless one becomes intensely calm and tranquil, we'll generally not have the meditators focus on the neutral feelings. If there's an intense or an exceptional feeling of calm, then we'll have the meditators focus on it. Otherwise, the neutral feeling, which persists for most of the time, we will focus instead on the physical or the sensual experience, for instance, seeing, hearing, and so on. Now, I put a note in the translation of feelings here, when experiencing a pleasant worldly feeling. He understands I experience a pleasant worldly feeling. And the difference between a pleasant spiritual and a pleasant worldly feeling is quite clear. I had a little bit of confusion about the painful spiritual feeling, because it's hard to think that, you don't normally think that a spiritual feeling could be painful. The difference is a worldly feeling is based on the senses and based on desire. Worldly pleasant feelings are when you see something beautiful and you become happy about it. You like it and want it, and it brings you pleasure. Spiritual feeling is when you give charity, or when you undertake morality, or when you practice meditation, and you feel good about that. It feels good to be practicing, or happiness arises as a result, but not based on desire. A painful worldly feeling is easy to understand. When a person gets angry, this is a painful worldly feeling. But the painful spiritual feeling, as I understand it, refers to when one feels when one feels this sense of urgency, one sees that things are impermanent and that there are problems and so on. And the longing that arises, as it says in the sutta, distress comes from the longing that arises in one who is filled with longing for the unexcelled liberation when experiencing the inconstancy of forms and so on. When one sees that clearly, one becomes, one gains a longing for freedom from it, which is, in the Visuddhimagga, is called munchito kamayata jnana. One actually feels distress. One feels bored based on this atanibindati dukhe, so one becomes disenchanted, and this is a painful spiritual feeling. It means, based on the meditation, the distress that arises. And so technically speaking, from an Abhidhamma point of view, it's still unwholesome, I would say, but it can be associated with a sense of urgency, which is based on wisdom. But the urgency isn't the painful feeling, isn't the suffering feeling. But meditators, it's quite apt that meditators do actually feel these painful feelings, like quite a bit of distress when they see how impermanent the mind is, for example. They feel like their mind, like they're going crazy sometimes. Meditators will often feel like they're going crazy because they can't control their mind in the way they used to. They realize that the mind is out of their control, and so they think something's wrong, until the teacher explains to them that actually that's quite ordinary, quite normal and quite expected. It's a part of nature. It's the truth of reality that the mind is uncontrollable. But you can read the sutta in Majjhima Nikaya 137, the Salayatana Vibhanga Sutta, which talks about these different types of feelings. But in brief, there are only three types of feelings. In the briefest brief, there is neutral, there is painful feelings, neutral feelings, and pleasant feelings. And so in the practice of Satipatthana, we'll be focusing on the body, and then a pain will arise. And then we ask the meditators to direct their mind towards the pain. If it's pain in the legs, pain in the back, pain in the head, we have them focus on that. And you can actually focus on it until it disappears. This is one, I think, key that people don't quite realize, that mindfulness of the feelings shouldn't be considered or the feelings themselves shouldn't be considered a distraction from one's meditation. Mindfulness of, or the feelings should be considered to be a valid object of one's mindfulness. And so at that point, one can leave, put aside the practice or the observation of the physical. So if one's focusing on the stomach, rising, falling, one can leave that behind entirely for the duration of time that the feeling is clearly observable. So you'll be sitting in meditation and you'll have pain arise. Focus on the pain as your meditation object. We have one meditator here now who is asking questions about this, because from her point of view, it seemed like it was just causing more pain. When you focus on it, sometimes the pain gets worse. Sometimes it goes away, sometimes it comes back. It doesn't go away consistently, and you can't control it. You say to yourself, pain, pain. Sometimes it gets worse, sometimes it goes away. This is the way it is. And so her feeling was, well, why should one focus on it? Why should one sit? Sorry, the point being that she had a persistent pain that she thought was probably from an accident that she had had, or surgery that she had had on her knee. And so she felt like sitting in that position was just bringing back the pain for no reason. And if she sat in a different position, she wouldn't have the pain. So we talked about it, and I said, well, yeah, certainly you could change postures. But what we're dealing with in meditation here is a controlled environment for us to, for the specific purpose of observing these phenomena, like the pain. Whereas the world is, and our ordinary life is, an uncontrolled environment. So the reason why we're coming to practice here is to study these things that we will encounter in daily life, in our lives. And when it comes time for you to experience these pain in your daily life, you won't, because it's uncontrolled, because you can't put the brakes on and back out of it like you can here, you'll be much more hard-pressed to actually come to terms with it and deal with it mindfully. What you have here is a chance to explore this pain. You know, here, yes, you have a persistent pain and it keeps coming back. So you have a chance to see what it's like, see how your mind reacts to persistent pain. And at first it was kind of, you know, she got quite a little bit upset about it. And when I explained it like this, and that you know, this is the reason why you're here, is to train yourself. Because if you have a hard time dealing with it here, think of how hard a time you're going to have dealing with it when you can't back away, when you can't limit it, when you can't put a pillow under your leg and make it a little bit easier to bear. So I said, here you can experiment, you can control everything. You can have a little bit of pain, you can have a lot of pain. And so as a result, you can see your reactions to pain without without going crazy based on the pain. If it's too much, back off a little bit. Once you're able to deal with it, go towards it. And that gave her quite a bit of reassurance and changed her practice. And as a result, changed the whole nature her whole way of looking at things. She came back the next day and her whole practice had changed. She was, I mean, in a good way, she had become much more open and relaxed. She had let go. She had changed her viewpoint from one where we ordinarily try to escape suffering to one where we overcome it and we rise above it and we live with it, which is, of course, far more sustainable. It's something that you can actually something that can actually allow you to escape suffering, because otherwise you're always running away from it. And so she actually let the pain stay. I mean, I gave her the choice. I didn't push her to do it. I said, you can do it either way, but this is the difference. And so she's like, okay, I know. And she went back and did it, and she said, the pain is not a problem anymore. Because you start to realize, you can only realize it when you're doing intensive meditation, really. But in intensive meditation, you start to realize how silly it is. There's a disconnect there. The pain itself and your reaction to it are actually quite disconnected. They have no relation to each other. There's no reason, and you see this only through intensive meditation. You can appreciate it intellectually, but to see it clearly, you have to practice intensive meditation, and you see that there's no reason for us to get, there's nothing intrinsically painful about the pain or undesirable about the pain. And I explained to her what will always, this standard explanation of the different types of suffering. You can say that in general there are four types of suffering. The ordinary type of suffering that we understand in a worldly sense is dukkha vedana. We understand the truth of suffering to be dukkha vedana, but this isn't the truth of suffering. This is suffering as a feeling. So we think of feelings as being a suffering. What is suffering? Suffering is the painful feeling. And for this reason, we spend most of our time running away from suffering, chasing it away, taking pills, taking medicine, going to see a masseuse, or we're just running away from difficult situations. If you are even a little bit mindful during these study courses, you'll see that your body is moving around quite a bit. You tend to shift, and unless you're being quite mindful, you'll find that you're shifting in your chair and adjusting your position based on the pain that you experience that arises. As soon as it arises, the intention is to change the posture. The second type of suffering is dukkha sabhava. The reason why people come to undertake spiritual practice is because they come to see that suffering is an intrinsic part of reality, and it is a fact of life. So we come to see that old age is a part of life, sickness is a part of life, death is a part of life, and these are things that one can't avoid. Suffering is an inherent part of reality, or there are certain sufferings that you can't escape. And the escape from suffering, from painful feelings, is only temporary, because they're a part of reality. All that you gain from running away from them is an increase in aversion, an increased aversion towards the experience. So the next time you feel the pain, it gets worse for you. This is why people come to look for a better way. They realize that worldly ways of dealing with pain are insufficient. And so they come to take on to look beyond this and say, how can I change my mind, for example? Then they begin to practice. Hopefully they come to Buddhism and realize the Buddha's teaching and begin to practice the Buddha's teaching on Satipatthana. And then they come to see that the truth of suffering is this, that it has nothing to do with the feeling, it has to do with our attachments to them. They come to see that the truth of suffering is that, or the reality of suffering is the inconstancy, that things are changing all the time. When they focus on the pain, they see that it's changing. Sometimes here, sometimes there. When you practice intensive meditation, you'll see that the pain actually moves around. First it's here, then it's there. And one that also helps you to realize how ridiculous our attachment to it is. Sometimes you acknowledge it gets worse, and you realize that focusing on it is just a means of exacerbating it, or clinging to it, or getting caught up in it. There's no way you can make it better. And the realization that it's not under your control. So even fixing the mind on it doesn't fix the pain. When a person realizes this, then there comes about this letting go. When I explained to her about how it's not you, it's not yours, and so on, and then she went back and she was able to see through it and realize that actually the truth is, it's just arising and ceasing. This is called dukkha lakkhana. You start to change the way you look at suffering. You see that actually the pain isn't suffering at all. The problem is that I'm clinging to something that can't be clung to. I'm trying to fix something that can't be fixed. And you see the three characteristics. Once you see the three characteristics clearly, you begin to realize that this is the truth of life. And eventually it dawns on the meditator. It comes in a flash of insight that this is the nature of all reality. One sees repeatedly to such a degree that it becomes a realization in the mind. The mind says, this is reality. There arises this insight. There's no way out of this. This is intrinsic to reality. This is the way reality is. It's impermanent, unsatisfying, and uncontrollable. And then the mind lets go. And this is where the Four Noble Truths. This is called dukkha satya. So the truth of suffering is this realization that reality isn't subject to one's control. It doesn't belong to oneself, and it can't be made stable or satisfying. And then the mind lets go. So just a little bit of this is a little bit of explanation as to why we would actually want to focus on the feelings. And the answer is that, in brief, so we can come to rise above our misunderstanding about what is suffering, about them being suffering. The painful feelings are not suffering. Suffering is the clinging to that which is impermanent, unsatisfying, and uncontrollable, which is everything that has arisen. So this is in regards to painful feelings. The acknowledgement, some people can grasp that quite clearly. Yes, I have attachment to painful feelings, but why do I have to acknowledge pleasant feelings? Isn't the point to be to find happiness? Isn't the happiness a good thing? But the problem with painful feelings is the same problem that will arise with pleasant and neutral feelings. Clinging. We cling to the painful feelings as being unpleasant. We cling to the pleasant feelings as being pleasurable, as being positive, as being attractive. Simply put, liking arises, attachment arises to both neutral feelings and pleasant feelings. The way it's explained in the text is that suffering is of three kinds. There's the dukkha-dukkha, which is intrinsic suffering. Then there is sankhara dukkha, which is the suffering caused by having to form or having to build or work at an experience. Work at keeping something. It comes from having to work and maintain. Maintenance, you could say, suffering as being maintenance. And then viparinama dukkha, which is suffering caused by change. So painful feelings are suffering, unsatisfying, because they're intrinsically suffering. No one could be satisfied by painful feelings. Neutral feelings are unsatisfying because you have to work to maintain them. So this peace and calm that you have is dangerous. It's dangerous, and not in and of itself, but the danger is the meditator will begin to believe that it's permanent, it's stable, not realizing that it has to be maintained. If one isn't clearly mindful of it and watching it arise and cease, one will get the misunderstanding that it is somehow permanent. And based on that misunderstanding, there will arise suffering. Based on that misunderstanding, one will work and work and work and have to work life after life to maintain this, to develop this. Work day after day, actually, to maintain this. And will miss the fact that one is actually engaged in a stressful activity. Because then work, 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 and then you feel peaceful. Work, 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 and you feel peaceful. So you miss the fact that you have to work for this. It's not satisfying. As soon as you stop working, it fades away. This is the suffering inherent in neutral feelings. Happy feelings are a cause for suffering because they change. So one becomes dependent on them or accustomed to them and partial towards them. And as a result, when they disappear, one is unsatisfied. Unless one can be clearly mindful of all of these feelings, the defilements that exist in the mind will lead to the tendency of attachment to these, the aversion to suffering feelings, the habit of working to build, to create neutral feelings, and the habit of clinging to pleasant feelings. And as a result, there will arise these three types of suffering. So very important, a very important part of our meditation that is often overlooked. One of the prime sticking points for meditators is these three feelings. So people understand mindfulness of the breath, even mindfulness of the body, but they forget mindfulness of the feelings. And as a result, they get stuck on pleasant or neutral feelings. And again, they really do get stuck. One of the most common questions that is asked, that I've been asked when going to give guest lectures to people who are not practicing in this tradition, is that they've been practicing meditation for some time, and they've come to a point where they just feel quiet, where they just feel silent, and there's really nothing, and they don't know what to do at that point because they don't know how to meditate there. And more than that, they tend to think that that's it, you know, there's nothing else. And after some time, they realize that when they stop, their defilements just come back. So they're wondering how to continue, what they can do to, or what they ask sometimes, what they can do to prolong this state. And so it's at this point that we have to explain mindfulness of the feelings, because this is a calm feeling, a feeling of a neutral feeling that is actually very important to be mindful of. One can also be mindful of quiet. One can consider it to be pasati. And it could come under Dhamma Nupassana at the end. Mindfulness of quietude. You know, mindfulness of Dhammas. So you say to yourself, quiet, quiet. Just reminding yourself this is something that has arisen. Something that has appeared. Or you can say calm, calm. If it appears to you to be calm. So quite important. And yes, we can just focus on the feeling until it goes away. Can and should. Meditators should be train themselves to be mindful of even painful feelings until they disappear, as pain or aching. Even if they get worse, Buddha said, even to the point where it might take their life. Sharpened and deadly pains, or pains that feel like you're going to die. So, mindfulness of the feelings. Quite simple, but very, very important. The third satipatthana is mindfulness of the mind. And here we have a bit of a dilemma, which you can only see as a dilemma if you're thinking theoretically, because if you're thinking practically, there's no dilemma. We have the Buddha giving a sequence giving these things in sequence, and as a result, seeing the people's minds develop as he's giving the talk, and therefore guiding them from one topic to another. Because the problem we have is, in citta nupassana we have a mind full of anger, a mind full of greed, a mind full of delusion. But if you look down in Dhamma Nupassana, we also have these. So if one is angry, this can be the hindrance. And so we say, well, which is it? Is it citta nupassana? Is it Dhamma Nupassana? This isn't really how we should be. We should be focusing on this. If you want to go literally by the sutta, then you have to, as I said, follow it as a guided meditation technique. Otherwise, we have to understand what is the Buddha talking, what is the general theory. We shouldn't take theory away thinking that theory, we have an overlap of theory, because the theory is very basic. You know, the theory of the body, the theoretical framework, is not the whole of the sutta. The sutta is a practical teaching, it's a guided meditation. The theoretical aspect of citta nupassana, mindfulness of the mind, is the state of the mind, that the state of the mind is impermanent. So being mindful of whatever kind of mind arises, whether it be a mind with greed or a mind without greed, a mind with hate, a mind without hate, a mind with delusion, a mind without delusion. The word isn't ignorance, actually. He's taking liberty here. The word is delusion. It has to be delusion. Moha. No. Avidya would be ignorance. But anyway, splitting hairs. Mind with delusion. So some type of delusion, some type of wrong understanding, some type of conceit it could be, or whatever. Worry it could be. Doubt it could be. Not just ignorance. And so what I think is a little bit more useful theoretically is after that part, after those three, the shrunken state, the distracted state, the great state, the not great state, you know. The state with some superior to it, as something superior, as with something superior, state of consciousness with no mental state superior to it. Point being, the point is here that good and bad states, one is aware of all states in the mind. So the way we explain this, just to keep it simple, especially to new meditators, if you want to put this into practice, and not worry so much about the overlap, because we're going to deal with the rest of the stuff in Dhamma Nupassana, then the mind is just thinking. The mind is when something arises in the mind, some concept, some idea arises in the mind, whether it be good thoughts, bad thoughts, thoughts that you like, thoughts that you don't like, thoughts about the past, thoughts about the future, distracted thoughts, focused thoughts. In the end, it's all just mind. It's all consciousness. And again, the word consciousness might be a little bit overly intellectualizing this. The word is citta, which really just means mind. You know? Consciousness is a fairly big word. Whatever state the mind is, if it's quiet, then you know it is quiet. If it's not quiet, you know it is not quiet. But the qualities of the mind, lust and so on, all the way down to quiet and not quiet, are going to be dealt with in Dhamma Nupassana. So here we can just think of it as being the mind. Whatever state the mind is, you know it as thinking, for example, or planning, or remembering. Whatever the mental action is, you know that as mental action. Or you can take this literally and say, saragang jittang. This is the mind with raga. But I think if you want to be quicker about it, you can just say raga or lust. When lust arises, just say lust, lust. And Sayadaw Usilananda is quite clever at this one. He says, in English, if you say angry when you're acknowledging, then it's Dhammanupassana. If you're saying anger, it's Chittanupassana. Is that correct, or is it the other way around? If you're saying angry, that's Chittanupassana. And if you're saying anger, that's Dhammanupassana. Because angry is pointing out that the mind is angry. If you're saying anger, then that's Dhammanupassana, pointing out that this hindrance has arisen. This anger has arisen. Or this... The other thing is that the hindrances are not actually synonymous with these three, you know. The hindrances are another way of explaining these three, but they are a little bit different. Like vyapada is actually ill will when you have hatred towards someone else, but it can also just be ill will towards anything when you don't have aversion towards something. No? Kama chanda is in regards to kama. It doesn't mean liking everything. It doesn't mean greed for everything, but in practice it's quite synonymous, and the hindrances are synonymous with most of what's going on here. If the hindrances are present, one knows they're present. If they're not present, so the easiest way to understand Chittanupassana is just in regards to all of the states of mind as being thinking. If the quality of mind is most obvious, most prominent, and then one should focus on that, but then it would be more the hindrances or yeah, one of the hindrances. But really that's really theoretical, whether it's Chittanupassana or whether it's Dhammanupassana. We're talking about the same thing, no? It doesn't really matter. You don't have to sit there and saying, wait, should I be doing Chittanupassana or should I be doing Dhammanupassana? Either you're mindful of thinking, remembering, planning, and so on, or you're mindful of the accompanying emotion, liking, disliking, drowsiness, distraction, doubt, worry, restlessness, confusion, and so on. Okay, so with citta, let's just keep it simple in regards to knowledge of the mind. I don't think there's much more to say about that. I could explain these all in detail. I'm not quite clear on all of these, what the technical meaning of all of these terms is. No, we have vikitang, jitang, sankitang, which is the focused state, I believe. Just give me a second here. Yeah, here we have a list of them. So, sankitang cittang is the state fallen into sloth and torpor. You see, so it's just the tinamidha, no? So if you're to say that this is jittanupassana, then you have to ask, well, what is the hindrances then? So the way to understand it is that this is a guided meditation, and the Buddha's going according to the nature of the minds of the people listening. And if we're going to take theoretical data out of this, or knowledge out of this for our own practice, then we have to see that the framework is just the citta, not the state of the mind. Vikitang means having udaccha kukuccha in it. Mahagatang is where one enters into jhanas. No? So this is, if a person is practicing jhana, one is aware of this state of mind. And then it's difficult to say thinking, no? And this is where the idea of the mind comes in. So you could even say to yourself, mind, being aware of your consciousness. Or knowing is what we tend to have people say. Knowing. This awareness, or you could even say aware, or awareness, just being aware of this, aware of your own awareness. and seeing the jhana states as also being impermanent, unsatisfying, and uncontrollable. Ammahagatang jittang is that state which is not in the jhana. So when you come out of jhana, knowing that state as being not jhana state. Sa uttarang jittang, anuttarang jittang, with something higher than it and something without something higher than it. So anuttarang is those states in the jhana realm, those minds in the jhana realm. Samahitang is the quieted state where one has entered into jhana. Asamahitang is where one hasn't entered into jhana. Vimuttang chittang is the mind which is emancipated from defilement. And avimuttang is where one is the mind that is not free, that has defilement in it. And yeah, the commentary explains even samoha chittang is either one of the two hindrances. It means it either has doubt, vichikicca, or agitation, udaccha kukuccha. That's also in the Abhidhamma. Okay, next we come to the five hindrances. I don't know, I'm not sure if we can finish the sutta today. We've only been going an hour. We normally have 2 hours for the session, so let's see how far we can get in this sutta. Because I don't really need to go into too much detail here. If people have questions, they can ask questions. Otherwise, it's quite straightforward. I think going into too much detail can just get boring, and all of the theoretical data is available in the commentary if you're interested. So the five hindrances we have: kama, chanda, vyapada, and so on. And these can be quite daunting, I think, for a new meditator. We're scrolling down to the paragraph that's highlighted. When sensuality is present, the bhikkhu knows, I have sensuality. So how do you sit there and say to yourself, I have sensuality? It's quite difficult, no? Kama chanda. So in practice, it's much easier to, if you want to be systematic about it, to have a simple word. So we use the word liking or wanting to focus on kama chanda. If you have disliking, you say disliking. Or if you have vayapada, which is ill will, I believe, but here he says anger. So anyway, if you have anger, you know, angry, or anger, so. So we have liking, disliking, or angry, and then we have tired for udaccha kukuccha, or lazy or drowsy, distracted or worried for udaccha kukuccha, and then doubt or confusion or doubting or confused for vichikicca. Think of simple. Simple explanations. Now, the other interesting thing about this section is what the Buddha says after being aware of the sensuality, because you're also aware of not having sensuality, and the implications of that, as well as the other passages, understands how the arising of non-arisen sensuality comes to be, understands how the abandoning comes to be, understands how the non-arising in the future of abandon, once it's abandoned, how it doesn't arise in the future. The meaning is one becomes skilled in one's meditation practice, that through the practice of all four satipatthana, one comes to realize that actually there's no reason for these hindrances to arise. They're not natural, they're not inherent, they're not a part of us, they're not me, they're not mine, they're not I. And this is important to emphasize, obviously, because these are hindrances. These are things that get in the way of our meditation practice. So knowing how they arise doesn't mean you have to sit around intellectualizing, but you actually experience and you see, ooh, I'm actually giving rise to this anger. And realizing that it doesn't need to be. Becoming skilled in terms of noticing that when you're really and truly mindful, you don't have greed, you don't have anger, these things don't arise. And it's the refining of the mind, refining of one's character. Realizing that it's actually stressful to have greed, to have anger, to have delusion. And as a result, giving them up. Naturally, giving them up as a natural part of one's practice. The commentary, just to note, if anyone's interested in it, goes into some detail as to how to get rid of the hindrances, I believe. Sense, for instance, sense desire is cast out by six things. Well, at first it talks about how right reflection, how when you reflect, and it explains basically what I explained, that through the practice of meditation, you come to get rid of it and you realize the way to be free from it. And as a result, you become free from the sense desire. But then it says there are also other ways to deal with these things. And I guess I can go through them. No, it's useful to talk about these, at least in brief. There are six things that can help you. So yes, it's true that meditation practice itself casts them out and is the major practice. But there are other things that you can do to support it. And so number one, taking up the sensuously inauspicious subject of meditation, which means, I suppose, asubha. Yeah, the impure or bad in regards to the asubha or the parts of the body and so on. Cemetery contemplations, contemplating a dead body that's livid, or what does it say, blue and bloated or with pus coming out of it or so on. Good for getting rid of lust. Number two, application for the development of jhana on the sensuously inauspicious subject of meditation. So if one has a lot of lust, the development of jhana will be easy for them based on asubha, for example, mindfulness of loathsomeness. The guarded state of controlling the faculties of the senses. So a good way, an important part of our practice has to be guarding the senses. When you see something beautiful, it gives rise to lust. When you hear something beautiful and so on. So guarding the senses is quite important. And we'll see later on that this is actually done partially or in main, actually, through the practice of satipatthana, saying hearing, seeing. But it should also be accomplished by guarding the sense, by avoiding, not looking at beautiful things, not listening to music and so on, not engaging in these things, avoiding the situation where the lust will arise. Because in the beginning, it can be quite overwhelming. If you don't avoid these things, then just like an alcoholic who doesn't avoid the bar, you can say, well, the problem isn't the bar, the problem is his mind, if he can just control his mind. But it's very hard to do that when you put the alcoholic in the bar, so you should avoid those kind of places. In the same way, a meditator who has a lot of lust should avoid looking at beautiful things and so on, at least in the beginning, at least until they're able to overcome their lust. Mm-hmm. moderation in food, very important. If you eat too much, it has an impact on the chemicals and the hormones in the body, which give rise to addiction, and actually strengthen. They don't create liking, but they strengthen the pleasure, which as a result makes one like it even more, because the hormones are stronger and the chemicals in the brain. If you eat only a little bit, the desire can't arise. So it is good to eat not so much. Eat only one or two meals a day. This is why we do that when we're meditating. One good reason, because it helps diminish. It won't help you to overcome the wrong view, which leads you to have lust. That's what the main meditation is for. But these things can be a support to weaken it so that it's easier to deal with. As I said, this goes back to the idea of the laboratory. Our meditation is a laboratory, and if we just try to practice meditation out in the world, it's quite difficult because it's an uncontrolled environment. Here we can control it. You can eat so little that there doesn't arise lust, and you just lie around weak all the time. So when you say, well, that's not enough, I want to feel a little bit of lust so I can learn to deal with it and learn to understand it and see what causes it and see and adjust my behavior so it doesn't arise. So then you eat a little bit more, but then you find a balance so that you don't eat too much and don't therefore have too much sense desire arising. Number five, the sympathy and support of good men in the endeavor, good people. Having people who are also practicing, people who are also trying to give it up, people who have given it up, having a teacher, having companions who are also dedicated to giving it up. Because if you're surrounded by people who are not, or even if you're alone, it's very easy for these things to overwhelm you. But when you have the reminder of other people who can admonish you and who can talk to you and who you can talk with about these things, then it reminds you again and again of the negative aspects of clinging and so on. And number six is the talk. When you talk with these people who help you to remind you of the truth of it, because it's actually like an intoxication. The defilements intoxicate the mind to the point that you're not even sane not even sober anymore. It gets to such a point that you can't stop people. If a person is really full of lust, then it's very difficult. And this is the situation we come across with monks who want to disrobe. If a monk wants to disrobe, very difficult to stop them. My teacher once said there are three people you can't stop. One is a person who is about to defecate. Two is a person who is about to give birth. And three is a person who is about to disrobe. The first two are quite easy to see. The third one is debatable. It's kind of a joke because you can actually, in some cases, stop people, but very difficult. And if a person is really going to disrobe, there's not much you can do to change it because their mind is so intoxicated. No matter what you say, they don't believe it. They believe it and they'll say, yes, I agree, but I still want to disrobe. It's quite pernicious because the defilements aren't in any way associated or related to wisdom and understanding. They're not rational. Okay, so that's the first one. Anger has six things as well. So besides simply saying angry, what can help us when we have so much anger that we don't know what to do, that we're unable to be mindful? Number one, take up the practice of love, of metta, as meditation. So we all should be quite aware of this one. Practicing metta is quite useful for anger, especially towards the person who you're angry at. Start with someone you love, go on to someone who you don't care about, and then go on to someone who you don't like. Back and forth like this until you can be the same about all of them. And that helps you to at least diminish the anger to the point where you can then practice mindfulness on it. Number two, developing metta to the point of entering into jhana. number three, reflecting on one's actions as one's own property. So if you read the what's the sutta, Koda, I think there's actually a Koda Sutta or Koda, I can't remember what the names of the suttas are, but there's many suttas on anger, the dealing with anger, suttas on dealing with anger, that talk about this, reminding yourself that these people, this is a problem for them, not for me. What they're doing, you know, we always feel injustice when people do bad things to us, thinking, I don't deserve that. Why is this happening to me? The realization that this is happening to you for a reason, that this is cause and effect, this is how things go. You have some problem with this person, or you stub your toe on something. Why does it happen to me? Well, it happens to you because of the way you moved your foot, which is conditioned by causes and could very well be karmic. The neglect that you have in your mind and so on. And the other part is that the person who has done you harm is also subject to their actions. So when you hate someone, see, the word isn't anger here. That's why it's specifically relating to ill will towards other beings. When someone has done bad things to you, you realize that justice will come. You know, the realization that actually you should feel sorry for these people. That what's going to happen to this person is quite bad. And if you get angry and continue it, you're going to create, that's what's going to create true suffering for you. Number four, abundance of wise consideration. So reflecting wisely, or even just abundance of meditation as angry, seeing how much suffering comes from anger. Number five, sympathetic and helpful companionship. And number six, the talk. So associating with good people and talk. This you'll see in all of them. This is common to all of them. Association with people who are also working to get rid of them, or who have already gotten rid of them. And talking with those people. Six things that lead to giving up tinamida, or sloth and torpor, tiredness, drowsiness. Number one, seeing the reason of sloth and torpor in the fact of eating too much or gluttony. So I guess it means moderation in eating, no? Or realizing that one is eating too much. Number two, changing the postures. Very important. So this is something that we always teach meditators. If you're sitting and you get tired, get up and walk. The Buddha gave this talk to Moggallana. When Moggallana was sitting in meditation, he was drowsing, nodding off. The Buddha said, oh, there's different ways you can deal with this. You can get up and walk. You can wash your face. You can rub your arms. You can pull your ears. You can do some chanting or so on. And one, you can reflect on the perception of light. This is number four in this list. So thinking of light, or when it's dark out, turn on a light, or sit there and imagine a light in your mind or so on, or think of it as being day or so on. Number five, staying out in the open where there's wind and breeze, and as the Buddha said, looking in the four directions, looking up at the sky, which helps you to lose this idea of hibernating. You know, some people were animals in their past life, and so when they go into their room, they just want to curl up and go to sleep. Humans are the same. You know, we get into our bedroom and we feel we want to go to sleep, but when you sit outside, it gives you more energy. Number five, sympathetic and helpful companionship. And number six, stimulating talk. Six things that lead us to overcome agitation and worry. Number one, knowledge. So, when you have knowledge and theoretical knowledge, you come to realize that there's no need to worry about the past things that we've done or feel guilty about things that we've done. Just stop doing them again. And when one learns more and more, one becomes confident. And because of confidence, one's mind settles down. One doesn't have to think so much because one has knowledge. Number two, questioning. When you question, And you have to be careful about these things, actually, because if you know too much, it can actually lead to more agitation, where the mind becomes more confused. But anyway, understanding of disciplinary rules. What the commentary is talking about is kukucha, where one becomes worried about one's past behavior, because knowledge will help one to avoid bad behavior and also help one to realize that one shouldn't feel guilty about it. Kukucha means guilt, really, or feeling guilty, feeling worrying about these things, which is a hindrance and actually an unwholesome state. Number four, association with those more experienced and older than oneself in the practice of things like virtue, because then one will be have an example and be able to practice stronger and better virtue. And number five, sympathetic and helpful companionship. And number six, stimulating talk. Six things that help us to overcome vichikicca, or doubt and confusion. Number one, the state of being learned in the Buddha's teaching. So this is where knowledge helps you to overcome doubt. Number two, inquiring about the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, because when you ask about the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, it gives you faith, and it helps to settle the mind and think, wow, I am doing a good thing following these people, following this teaching. Number three, understanding thoroughly the nature of the discipline. Probably has something to do with doubting about one's morality. Number four, of being decided about the truth of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So studying and questioning and so on until one becomes confirmed in their mind that what the Buddha taught was true, at least in an intellectual sense. This can help in the meantime. Of course, once you practice meditation, the doubt disappears because you have clear confidence. You know, you're sure, you have certainty that what the Buddha taught or what you're practicing is correct, because you practiced it. Number five, sympathetic and helpful companionship. And number six, stimulating talk. So that's mindfulness of the hindrances. Next we come to mindfulness of the aggregates, the five aggregates. And again, if you're taking this all together, you have to say, oh, because the aggregates are really the four foundations of mindfulness. It's a huge overlap. Rupa is kaya, vedana is vedana, sanya sankara, that's involved in, for example, the sankara or in the hindrances. Sanya is part of the citta when you're thinking about the past or future. But it's not explicit, and if you're dealing with this as a meditation practice, then you get to this point and the meditator's minds are sharp. You can start talking about breaking the reality up into the five aggregates and what we cling to. But as a guided meditation, you can see that the Buddha has now just come to a new way of opening up his students' minds. And the other thing is that there are certain parts of this that aren't explicit. So, for instance, sanya, the Buddha hasn't really talked about memory and apperception. So when one recognizes something, one can say recognizing or remembering or so on. And the commentary says he mentions this in order to explain it in a different way. Another reason for breaking it up in different forms is because of different people's character types. For some people, mindfulness of the body is the best. I think we talked about this in the introduction, but why there are four foundations. For some people, feelings. For some people, mind. For some people, the aggregates is the best way to talk about it, because it's mostly mental. For people who have attachment to the mind, when you talk about the aggregates, you break the mind up into small parts. So here we have citta nupassana wasn't broken up. Now it's being quite broken up, separating rupa out into one and then breaking up the mind into four, vedana, sanya, sankara, and vijnana. In meditation practice, it's really just another way of understanding the four foundations of mindfulness, but in some greater detail. So what are the five aggregates? And the commentary doesn't go into much detail. As you can see, the sutta itself is quite brief, no? This is material form, this is the arising, this is the disappearance. So seeing that it arises and ceases, and the feelings arises and ceases, perception arises and ceases. Seeing, and I guess another part is seeing that these things are non-self, because Dhammanupassana is for the purpose of seeing non-self. I think I mentioned this, it's been so long now. Body, Kayanupassana is for the purpose of getting rid of the idea of beauty. Vedananupassana is for the purpose of getting rid of the idea of happiness, that somehow something could bring you happiness. Jittanupassana is for the purpose of giving up permanence. And Dhammanupassana is for the purpose of giving up the idea of self. So when you break reality up into the five aggregates, you break a being up into the five aggregates, it helps you see, and when you see them arising and ceasing, it helps you see them as non-self. And it goes quite well with the next section, which is the Chasu Ajatika Bahiresu Ayatanesu Ayatana, the six senses. And the eye and material form and the fetter that arises dependent on both. Because whereas the aggregates are mostly mental, the ayatana, the sense bases, are mostly physical. So the aggregates, rupa is physical, vedana, sanya, sankhara, vijnana are mental. With the sense bases, the eye and form are physical, the ear and sound are physical. You have, if you count them up, you have what? Except for the sixth one, the mind, you have 10 physical, then in the mind you have one that can be physical. Dhamma can be both physical and mental, apparently. So you have 11 physical, and then what is mental in here is the mind, and I don't even think he mentions it here. You have eye, and well, then you have the fetters as well. But it's more physical, it's more dealing with the physical. And so you might ask, well, why deal with them both? Because if you've already got the five aggregates, why do you need to deal with the six senses? And it's because of, as stated, the people's different attachments. It's also because of how it appears to the meditator. The six senses is actually much more useful in the sense that we haven't dealt with it yet. And this is something we'll give to meditators after a day or so practicing. Once they've gotten the basic meditation technique, which is the four foundations and basically the five aggregates, then we add something new. So when they saw something, they didn't know what to do. When they heard something, they didn't know what to do. When we come to this teaching, now we have some way of dealing with this. When you see something, it should be seeing. When you hear something, it should be hearing. When you smell something, it should be smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. This is as taught in the Bahiya Sutta. It's actually not taught explicitly here. It understands the eye. But it's really, the meaning here is that in the same way as before, where standing is just standing and so on, seeing should also be just seeing, as the Buddha said, "Ditte ditta matang bhavisati." Very clearly says, when something is seen, it should only be seeing, or it should only be that which is seen. Ditta, ditta matta. It should be understood simply as seeing. When hearing something, it should be understood just as hearing. Sutte sutta matang bhavisati. When sensing something, mutte mutta matang bhavisati. It should just be what is sent. Jitte jitta matang bhavisati. When thinking, it should only be thinking. This is in the Bahiya Sutta, which is a very short sutta, which explains quite clearly how we should practice in regards to the six senses. So the point would be that Bahiya, the person hearing it, was probably very much attached to the physical. And as a result, the Buddha pointed out the physical senses. Okay, so that's the sense basis. The next section is mindfulness of the Bojanga. So how do we be mindful of the Bodhjhanga? I wouldn't say we have to be so exactly mindful of the Bodhjhanga, but it's very important teaching to keep in mind. I gave a talk on this last night, explaining how the Bodhjhanga works and why you can't really be mindful. We have a problem here is because mindful of mindfulness, right? You're being mindful of how much mindfulness you have. And the point is that this is the roadmap. This is where the mindfulness has to take us. If you don't have mindfulness, you have to work to develop it. And you work to develop until Dhammavicaya comes up. This is one way of explaining it, that it's actually just referring to the course. But it is true that you have to be mindful of these things, because you can become negligent about them otherwise. Even when good things arise, when mindfulness arises, the commentaries say, and you know, based on this passage, for example, that it can be a hindrance, because then you start to think, wow, look at how mindful I am. And so it doesn't therefore lead to Dhammavicaya. Sometimes you can have Dhammavicaya come up, this investigation come up, and it doesn't lead to effort because you instead start to, you know, think a lot. You start to think about it, and as a result you become tired. So Dhammavicaya, you have to see, do you have virya, for example? You have to be mindful of the Dhammavicaya, of the investigation, and be aware that you're investigating and so on. You have to somehow be clear about it. When virya arises, if there's too much effort, then it can lead you to distraction. Piti can be a problem because it can lead you to like it and to enjoy it. The point is that you always have to come back to being mindful. These things only develop if you're always being more and more mindful. So when mindfulness arises, it can lead you to stop being mindful, actually. You have to be mindful of it. You have to, once you're mindful, continue to be mindful. Once you're mindful, what should you do? Be more mindful. Once investigation arises, what should you do? Be more mindful. Once effort arises, what should you do? Be more mindful. And these things will arise more and more and more until you become enlightened. These are the factors of enlightenment. Even when pasati, this is what I said, you have to actually be mindful. When you have quiet, the only way to progress is to go back to the beginning and work on the base, which is the sati bodhjhanga. If you're not developing mindfulness, the bodhjhanga will not develop. You can't develop the other ones without basing them on mindfulness. So what this is a teaching is that once you develop more and more mindfulness, these others will come by themselves. You should never pick one of them and try to develop it, or even worse, get caught up in one of them, so that you stop being mindful entirely. The key is to be mindful, and that's actually quite clear from this passage, that even when any of these good things come up, what is it that you should do? Well, be mindful of them, even those ones. I have the enlightenment factor of calm. You know you have the enlightenment factor of calm. Say to yourself, calm, calm, remind yourself that you have it. It can also be an intellectual exercise. You can put some intellect into it in terms of judging yourself and seeing, do I have these things and why don't I have these things? And learning how to bring them about, right? It understands the arising and how it comes to be, and how the completion by culture of the arisen enlightenment factor comes to be. So how to bring it to completion, how to work to develop these things. And the same goes for the Four Noble Truths, because throughout all of this, the commentary has been explaining how these relate to the Four Noble Truths. Kaya, Vedana, and Citta, to some extent, are the truth of suffering. The mindfulness, it also says, mindfulness of the body and so on is the truth of suffering. Dhammanupassana also includes the cause of suffering. But in general, most of our practice is the truth of suffering. And so this final section, the section on the factors of on the Four Noble Truths, is a reminder that we should understand, in the end, we should understand it based on these Four Noble Truths. This is also the ending of the sutta and the ending of the practice. And in some cases, this would be enough for people to become enlightened. it's quite likely that during this sutta, you know, if you follow the commentaries or follow what has been written down about these suttas, based on what you see in other suttas, that people became enlightened just listening to this sutta. And the way the Buddha would do that is this, it's called the Anupubi Katha, the teaching in order. He would teach one thing, until finally he realized that the person's mind was pliant. And that's what he would do throughout this sutta, by leading people in a certain direction, until finally he got them here and he would teach them the Four Noble Truths and remind them to bring it all back to the Four Noble Truths. And then their mind would grasp this. They would be able to see it all as suffering. So when people get to like Sankharupeka Jnana, when they get to the higher stages of knowledge and they're truly at Upeka, which is the last Bodhjanga, right? So, I mean, whether or not people actually gain this, theoretically it also makes sense that we have the enlightenment factor of equanimity. It's the last thing the Buddha talks about, meaning this is the highest point. It's called Sankharupeka Jnana, when someone gets to be totally equanimous about things. There's no intellectual activity or no partiality. The mind is just clearly aware of things as being what they are. This is this, that is that, it is what it is. No more, no less. At that point, one comes to appreciate the Four Noble Truths. One comes to see the truth of suffering. Looking at everything, one sees that actually the truth of all these things is they have no intrinsic worth of any sort. There's no intrinsic worth in any of them. One sees that they are what they are, and as a result, one's attachment to them, one's partiality towards this or to that, or one's aversion towards this or that, decreases and decreases and decreases until the mind lets go. When the mind lets go, that's the second noble truth. Once one has let go, then there is the cessation. The cessation is the third noble truth. The path is the practice which leads to this, which is the overarching mindfulness, is the path which leads to the cessation of suffering. Or the moment which, the first moment of cessation is also considered to be the path, because it's at that moment that the defilements are severed, because of the realization of that moment. One's greed, anger, and delusion disappears, at least to a certain extent, depending on whether one has become a sotapanna, sakitagami, an anagami, or an arahant. So it's a very good way to end the sutta, because it seems to be very clearly what would the last thing that one has to teach in a meditator. And theoretically speaking, it's the last moment of one's meditation practice, the realization of the Four Noble Truths. It's not something intellectual. The Four Noble Truths are a moment. All Four Noble Truths are realized in a flash. And the commentary says it's like when you blow out a candle. No, when you light the candle. When you light a candle, the wax melts, the wick burns, darkness is dispelled, and light arises. So, darkness is dispelled as the cessation of suffering. I can't remember which this was. Anyway, four things happen, and these four are supposed to represent the Four Noble Truths all at once. It all occurs at once. The realization of suffering means the giving up of the clinging to suffering, to things that are suffering. The giving up of clinging is the cessation of suffering, and the path. The giving up is the path, and the cessation which results is the fruit. So it happens all at once. They are the final factor. Another way to look at Dhamma Nupassana, which I think is quite useful, is as a gradual teaching. So if you take the other three, Gaya, Vedana, Citta, you have a fairly complete practice already. But once you start to take them up, the Dhamma Nupassana, because Dhamma really in this sense means teachings. No. It's always translated as mind objects, but that's certainly not what it means in this context. I mean, I can't understand why how it means that. Because it's clear that what's being talked about here are not mental objects, are not mind objects, which Dhamma can mean. It's teachings. These are teachings of the Buddha. And if you look at them and if you think about what's being taught here and what the purpose of all of these things is, the best way to look at Dhamma is a roadmap for you or a guidebook for you. A